Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network. A couple of guests for you. One, Kevin Schesso. He's the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison Division of Extension, working in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. And Kevin, great to have you back.
Thanks, Larry.
Great to have you with us. Diana Alfeth, our other guest today, is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. And Diana, great to welcome you back as well.
Great to be here again, Larry.
So we're going to talk with these two about getting your yards and gardens ready for fall and winter. You may have some other kinds of plant questions, and certainly if you do, hope you'll join in. No matter the question, give a call at 800-642-1234 or send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Well, we've had some pretty cool temperatures this past week. How did your gardens fare in your areas? And you're both kind of in the same area a little bit. Kevin's a little north of you, I guess, Diana. But how are your gardens faring?
Well, we had frost advisory here in Pierce and St. Croix counties, but we didn't have widespread frost. I think there were some pockets in the lower areas, but nothing major killing for most people here. And I've talked with some colleagues this morning from Portage County. They had a few little specks of frost. And then over on the eastern side in Marinette County, they dodged the bullet too and didn't really have anything widespread. So our growing season should continue here. It's going to warm up next week. But Kevin, what about up by you? Did you get frost?
Yeah, believe it or not, we did. I think, you know, we're just a little bit farther north, and just the way our weather patterns are up here. I think our frost events were a little bit more widespread. Nothing really hard frost, but our plants in the teaching and display garden, especially our vine crops, and I know in my home gardens, all of our melons and squash, those basil plants, those are the first ones that go down in a frost, and that's the kind of frost damage we saw. It wasn't a hard frost, but I think it was fairly widespread, but didn't quite get to that really hard killing frost that ends the growing season. So we're still hanging in there as well. And personally, I look forward to this time of year with all the transitions that are happening. So weather being one of them, you can't change the tilt of the earth, as they say, and plants are responding.
And you don't feel like you have to pull weeds anymore at this time of the year because, you know, it's winter. I also talked with Darren Kimbler up in our Iron County office, and they did get killing frost the last few nights. So along the river, along the lake, they apparently are still okay. But inland, they got down into the mid-20s, so the growing season has ended for a lot of people up there.
Well, it's ending, but what advice do you have for cleaning up the yards and gardens?
Well, I think, you know, one of the main points that Kevin and I would really like to make is we've had a relatively rainy year in most parts of the state. We've had some dry spells, but especially early on, we had plenty of rain. And we have had for the last few years, we've had several wet years, so the fungal diseases have been just flourishing out there this year. Lots of foliar fungal diseases, lots of powdery mildew, septoria leaf spot has been taken down, lilacs and things across the state. And now is the time to start thinking about next year from that standpoint. So what we really need to do, if you have leaves that have brown blotches or spots or whatever it is, there's a lot of foliar fungal diseases that have been out there. And those diseases will overwinter on those leaves, and those spots on those leaves will give off spores next spring that will blow up in the air and infect the new tender leaves coming out in April and May and June, and then you'll have the diseases again next year. So it's really important to look at your plants, which ones have diseases on them, and clean up and dispose of those properly. And how you dispose of them kind of depends on your situation. In many cases, if you do active hot composting, you can put them on a hot compost pile that if they'll get up to 135 to 140 degrees, that will kill most of those spores and those diseases. If you're a lazy composter, like a lot of us are, where you just keep throwing things on a pile and it's a cool composting situation, that's not a great idea because those spores won't die if they don't get heated up. So your other options are if you live in an urban area, you can truck them off to an urban compost area and let them hot compost it. If you're in a rural area, you might have an option to burn some things. That's not always the most environmentally friendly kind of thing to do, but you can burn your diseased plant stuff, or you can bury them. You just dig a hole and bury them a foot deep, and they'll rot away, and those spores will die under the microbes of the soil and stuff and not be there to come and get you next year. So it's just really important to clean up those diseased leaves for next year. And we don't know how rainy next year will be, but just in case it's another wet year, we want to reduce the amount of inoculum that's floating around out there.
Yeah. For those who haven't gotten frost yet, have suggestions for extending the growing season? Kevin, you want to strike in?
Sure. Well, there's lots of options in that department. You know, like I said earlier, you can't change the tilt of the world, and our daylight is shortening, and the heat units and the intensity of the sun really is what plants respond to ultimately. But with that said, we can certainly find ways to protect our plants and keep them from those cold night temperatures, especially if we got another frost event. So, you know, season extension techniques are, you know, covering plants with some kind of cloth, light penetrating barrier, you know, this Remay or even, you know, sheets or plastic helps prevent, you know, that heat loss overnight, so we can extend the growing season in the fall by, you know, covering our plants. And that's the whole concept behind these high tunnels and caterpillar tunnels and other structures that people put up over their gardens and even individual plants. So this is the time of year where we can think about, you know, what we might do to cover our plants to, you know, just keep some of that ground heat in, because that's where most of the heat is this time of year, is what's still in the soil, and that'll radiate up overnight. And if we can capture some of that with some of these, you know, enclosures, that's probably the most practical way to do it. You know, there's other frost protection things we can do with water and overhead irrigation, but that's really designed for people who've got a high-value crop they want to try to save. Our cranberry growers up here do that all the time, and some of our other fruit growers. Basically, you're looking at some kind of way to, you know, insulate the plants with a covering would be the simplest thing to do at this time of year.
Yeah. We have every one of our phone lines filled. So maybe we should take some calls here. And Phil in Mount Horeb up first. Phil, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Larry. I'm calling because I intend to increase the size of my garden next year. I garden in beds 4 feet wide. And I'm wanting to kill the grass that currently occupies that area. This was tilled once before with a plow, and I collapsed the soil structure, much to my chagrin now. And I would like to rehabilitate this. I don't know how to get rid of that grass in a nutritionally safe way. I don't want to use any herbicides on it. So, and I'd rather not take the labor of clearing the turf with a sod remover. Mm-hmm. So I want to retain all of that nutrients in that top layer. I have a source of composted hay and manure and composted wood chips. I was thinking about using cardboard to cover that area that I wish to expand into. And I'm wondering if that is both safe and if there is a better way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds like a nice, ambitious project, and you're right. I mean, you can always, you know, spray it with glyphosate and kill the grass, but for a vegetable garden, not everybody wants to do that. So you do have a few options, and it is early enough in the season. So you can If you had a rototiller and you just rototilled it up and rototilled it like every week, you would probably kill off that grass, because every time it started to regrow, you'd kill it, you know, you'd work it up and stuff, and you could just do that right up until the ground freezes, and you'd probably get rid of the majority of that grass. Normally we would tell you to take that sod cutter and get rid of most of it first, but your other option is suffocating that grass. So there's probably still time this year that if you covered it with like black plastic so that it went in the dark and it couldn't do photosynthesis, it would die off, and you could leave that on right till spring. What you're talking about, like with putting cardboard down, is kind of a form of like lasagna gardening. And so that absolutely works. And you can use basic brown corrugated cardboard. It is organic because it's all cellulose. And people think that there's glue that holds the layers together, but that's just cellulose. It's just like pulp that holds it together. So take off any tape or labels or anything like that, and you can lay that down. You might even go two layers thick to make sure, because grass can be pretty tenacious, and then pile any kind of other organic matter that you have on top of it. So like you said, if you have composted wood chips or composted hay or leaves or any kind of organic, anything that was once a plant, manure, that kind of thing. And the deeper you pile it, the better. And then next year you can kind of mush that together and stuff to plant into. But you do have to worry about nutrients a little bit, just from the standpoint of all that organic matter can eat up nitrogen. But it is a way to suffocate out that grass without actually removing it or working it up. So, Kevin, what do you think about lasagna gardening type of thing in this situation?
Well, again, there's lots of ways to garden, lots of ways to prepare garden beds, and I'm a huge fan of, and I think, Larry, I've talked about this before, add more, till less, add more organic matter, do less tilling, you know, for lots of reasons. But if you're into raised bed gardening and don't want the traditional in-ground gardens and see long rows and having to run your rototiller up and down the rows or do hoeing and all that kind of stuff, raised beds are such a nice way to minimize all kinds of extra effort. So smothering the soil and covering it up, like Diana said, avoids all that extra tillage, and you're adding organic matter. So, yes, again, it just depends on how you want your final garden to be set up, and how you organize those raised beds and have walking paths in between and do all your gardening in those raised beds. You don't even have to use a rototiller if you don't want. So, yeah, everything Diane said, I think, is appropriate. Again, depends on situation.
Yeah, there you go, Phil. Thanks so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Diana Alfuth and Kevin Chesso, our guests today. Diana is a horticulture educator with Extension in Pierce County. Kevin Chesso works out of Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties for UW-Madison and Extension. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer today. Tyler Ditter, our engineer. And you are listening to the Ideas Network and Garden Talk. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guests, Diana Alfuth and Kevin Chesso. Diana works out of Pierce County for UW Extension. Kevin Chesso works out of Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. So kind of getting the east side of the state and the north side of the state, east and north side of the state covered here for you today. But they can talk about the whole state, so don't worry about that. Give a call with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email us at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Chris in Black Creek next. Hi, Chris.
Hi, Mr. Mueller. It's Chris Zander again, crystalsforkids.org. And for your guests, I'm really curious because I grew pumpkins when I was a kid, and the seeds from the pumpkins didn't grow as big the next year. And so I have a friend that grew the big sunflowers, and we're very curious if your guests know if they will grow as big if you reuse the second generation seed. And second, How do they make the hybrid seeds to begin with? That's my question, Larry. Thanks, guys.
All right. Thank you, Chris. Well, who wants to start? Diana, do you want to start?
Sure. So the whether or not the pumpkins will grow that big is usually they won't. And the same with sunflowers, because those sunflowers probably were a hybrid. And that means that they took two distinct parents and combined them to get those. Now, if you happen to have a variety that wasn't a hybrid, then the seeds should grow plants and flowers that would be similar to the originals. But how they get the hybrid in the first place, it gets ridiculously scientific and tedious, because they literally go out there and will remove either the male parts of the flowers that could be pollinating them and hand pollinate with pollen from their desired plants, and they put little bags over them to keep stray pollen from finding its way in there with bees and stuff. And so these fields where things are produced look really funky, because they are really protecting the female plants, or the ones that are going to provide the seed for your seed packets, from bees and insects and wind that would bring in pollen from elsewhere. So it's pretty crazy. So the question of whether or not your sunflowers will get as big is going to depend on where the pollen came from that pollinated the original flowers, the original seeds, and if there was hybridization involved originally. And then, of course, in any given growing season, it can be different, you know, different amounts of water and temperature and stuff. So there's never a guarantee. But yeah, there are some pretty serious hybridization techniques that go on out there.
Kevin, anything to add?
Yeah, well, that's the interest and the beauty and the curiosity with heirlooms. And a lot of times these heirlooms, because, you know, the name implies, they're passed down from generation to generation. And they are what we call, you know, open pollinated. So they kind of self-pollinate. And some plants are much more prone to that than others. Obviously, tomatoes, peppers, you know, cucumbers, any plant with a complete flower, meaning both male and female plant flower parts are in the same blossom. The vine crops have male and females flowers on two different, you know, separate flowers. So the male flower often comes out first. That pollen then has to be transferred to the female flower, and that's how pollination happens. So in that case, you're much more prone to cross-pollination, and that's where you'll get this mixing of genetics, and you'll get, you know, it's kind of like an inbred or a hybridization that way. But some plants are much more likely to be open pollinated. And, you know, there's a reason why we like that, because now we can save seeds and get a lot of that same genetics back. And incidentally, there is an initiative. While Diane was talking, I went online, and there's a UW Madison is involved in an open source seed initiative through the Irwin Goldman Lab. And it's all about trying to promote open pollinated, open source seeds that aren't necessarily covered by patents or plant protection, because they realize that we really need to have seeds that are available for seed saving and all that stuff. So if you know, go online, you can find that. It's the Open Source Seed Initiative, if people are interested in.
All right, there we go. Thank you again, Chris, for calling. Appreciate your call. Greg in Broadhead, on to you now. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Larry. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Sure.
I listen to your show whenever I possibly can, and it's a wonderful source of gardening information.
Thank you.
My question is, I use shredded oak leaves in my vegetable garden. I've done that for a number of years now, let's say 4 or 5 years. I'm wondering, is there anything I should be adding to that garden to counteract whatever adverse effects or from the oak leaves? And also, I have a pile of wood chips that's probably 4 or 5 years old. It could contain wood from any of the species of trees we have here in southern Wisconsin, possibly some walnut. But that is pretty well turned into a mulch, the pile itself. There's not wood chips anymore. It's turned into a good compost, actually. I'm wondering if there would have been some walnut in that pile, is that going to have a bad effect on the garden? Those are my two questions.
All right. Kevin, you want to start?
Okay. Yeah, sure. As far as the oak leaves go, I don't see a problem in using oak leaves. And matter of fact, most of our leaves and pine needles, we call that pine straw. There's nothing wrong with harvesting those local organic resources. If you have trees in your yard, you have free organic matter that we can use in our gardens. And I like to shred those, maybe mix them with some lawn clippings this time of year when, the leaves start to fall, put them in a bin and do some composting over the winter and into early spring. And then you can dig into those partially composted leaves and use them in your gardens as mulch. So they're relatively weed-free. They are high in carbon, of course. And, because of that, like Diana mentioned earlier with lasagna gardening, sometimes those high carbon sources can steal nitrogen. So whenever we enrich our soils, we have to think about that. And this would be a good case for Greg to consider taking a soil sample just to kind of get that information and see what your soil tests are. And that is always a good place to start when you're curious about how your garden soil is doing from all this, amendments. So a soil test would be in order to see whether or not, you might need to balance that soil with some other nutrients from all those organic, leaf additions. And as far as the wood chips, there's always a chance that you can have some pathogens and some of those juglones that are found in some of our, walnut type, either from the leaves or from the, from the bark itself. But if they're sitting around composted and older, most of those compounds should be leached out and decomposed. What I always like to suggest is if you have a material that you're not quite sure is safe to use for whatever reason, do a test. Take some of that composted wood chips, put it in a pot, mix it with some other organic materials or soil, and then grow something in it just to see how the plants respond. If there is juglone at high enough concentrations, tomatoes are a good test plant to use. And if that juglone is there, you'll see that, in how the plants respond. So that's just a simple way. It takes a little time, but if you've got a lot of it, you don't want to risk the chance of it, causing problems. Do a little test with a small amount.
Yeah, makes very good sense, for sure. You go ahead, Diana.
I was just going to mention that Kevin is absolutely right. Now is a great time for everybody to start looking at soil testing, because if you haven't done a soil test in a few years, things can change. And if you take the soil test now, you can get your results back, know what you have to change. If you have to, for example, if your pH has gotten too low and you need to add some lime, or if your pH has gotten high and you need to add some sulfur, putting it in the fall now so that it has time to break down and really have an impact on the soil before you plant next spring is a great idea. And we really recommend that you do a soil test where you send the soil test into a lab. There are, off-the-shelf little kits where you put some soil in a test tube and you match the color for the pH and stuff. And some of those are better than others, maybe, but the problem is that you're usually testing a tiny amount of soil, and you might have gotten a dead bug in there that skews your results, right? And it also, it's kind of a guess sometimes if you're matching a color thing. And those tests don't tell you what to do about it, okay? So it might tell you your pH is high or low, but it doesn't tell you what to do about it. Whereas a lab test, like from the UW Soil Lab, it will tell you exactly how much lime or sulfur you need to add to your personal soil to get that pH where it needs to be for what you want to grow. And soil is very different. If you have a real sandy soil or a clay soil or how much organic matter is in your soil, that makes a difference on how much of an amendment you would need to add. So now's a great time to do a soil test. And with the caller having added the oak leaves, he's probably got a lot of good organic matter in there. And but again, we recommend soil tests every 4 to 5 years because that'll tell you if you're high or low on a nutrient. And again, that pH is so important because that affects plants' abilities to take up nutrients. You can have all the nutrients in the soil in the world, but they can't take it up if the pH is way out of whack. So now is a great time to do some soil testing and amending.
Mm-hmm. And then mention, of course, when you send in that sample, what you intend to use that land for.
Exactly. So, and the UW Soil Lab is in Marshfield right now. You can go online and just Google UW University of Wisconsin Soil Lab and it'll come right up. And on there will be sample submission. It'll tell you everything you need to do and the submission form. You can print it out. And there are categories on there where you say, if you, for example, if you wanted to grow blueberries, you need that pH down in the fours. And so you put that on there, and then they'll tell you how much sulfur you need to do, or, you know, if it's even worth it.
yeah, may not even be worth it.
Right. So whether it's lawns or vegetable gardens or flowers or shrubs or fruits, you put that on there, and then they know, you know, where what your soil should be to be successful growing that, and they'll tell you what to do with your personal soil, because soil, that's the one thing with Wisconsin, we have gazillions of different kinds of soils. Those
yeah.
glaciers, you know, they drop stuff out all over the place, and it can change very drastically in a short distance. So what your soil is can be very different from your neighbor's, and it's really important that you test your personal soil.
Greg, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate it. Well, Ryan in Milwaukee is up next. Let's go there. Hi, Ryan.
Hi, Diana, Kevin, and Larry. Thank you. Longtime listener of your wonderfully produced show. Had a question about milky spore and nematodes, if this is the time of year, if in general it's recommended. We have Japanese beetles issue, and I've heard it might take care of the larvae or help us for next season. And then if there's other risks I should know about with regards to that, the effect of those treatments on other local flora and fauna, and if it should be done just on my garden or around the flowers in the whole yard too. Thank you.
Kevin, do you have Japanese beetles up in the Spooner area yet?
Well, this has been a disappointing year for us up here because for the 20-some years I've been here, they've always been someplace else. And this was the first year.
Now you got them.
I shouldn't say the first year. They're slowly making their march north, and I'm afraid that they are starting to show up in our backyards, which is unfortunate because I know for many, many people all across the state, Japanese beetles are just such a nuisance because of their voracious eating habits, and they're, you know, they really raise havoc. So I appreciate the fact that people are concerned about them and want to manage them as best we can. So
I don't have
a lot of personal experience with the milky spore. I do know it is a product that has been recommended, and just like all of our recommendations, especially with products that, you know, we have to read and understand the label directions and follow them. I don't know, Diane, if you're familiar with any research that we've done with it or where we're at with that. But
so earlier this year, we did a statewide Zoom webinar with PJ Leash, our insect specialist, and on Japanese beetles. And milky, so there's a couple things going on. So you can put stuff on your lawn to kill the grubs, okay? But it probably will have zero effect on how many adults you have feeding in your yard the next year, because they fly in. They fly in from a half a mile away. So if you have good plants that they want to eat, they're going to fly in. So killing all of the grubs in your yard probably isn't going to have any significant impact on how many adults you have. And milky spore is recommended a lot out there in popular sites and on social media, but there is really no research that shows that it's effective or significantly effective, and especially in Wisconsin. So not likely going to have a major impact. And again, PJ has more info on it, but it's just really not a... Yes.
You're not recommending it.
Well, no, and there is the milky spore. There is some of that in our soil, like naturally, and this is supposed to supplement it and attack the grubs and that sort of a thing. But it breaks down in the soil. Depending on your soil conditions, you may or may not have, you know, much of it like survive. With our colder winters in Wisconsin, that has an effect on it, so it's not going to persist as much as it will maybe in Florida or something like that. But there's just not any research that's supporting it being effective in making any significant difference in your Japanese beetle grub population. So, you know,
yeah, I guess that's the beauty of having two heads are better than one on some of these things. Milky spore, it's a fungal pathogen, you know, it's a bacillus, and it does have some efficacy, but again, they're stating, again, this is from a Wisconsin source, that they just don't have it's inconsistent in how effective it is, and maybe you get 20 to 25% control of the grubs, and that's what milky spore will impact, because the grubs are what are in the ground right now, and they'll emerge next year into the adults. And so there's two, you know, critters there, the grubs that live in the soil, and then of course the adult beetles. And the milky spore is applied to the soil and is meant to, you know, kill off some of those grubs, which it can do. But, you know, is it going to be significant enough where it's worth the cost and effort? You know, and there's that saying, nothing ventured, nothing gained. So there's nothing wrong with trying this. And maybe it does have enough of an impact in reducing some of those grub populations.
All right. There you go, Ryan. Thank you very much for calling. You can join in, too, by the way. We have some open lines. Get you on pretty quickly at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. AJ in Green Bay, it's your turn. Hi, AJ.
Hey there, guys. My question is, how do I go about getting or sending in a soil sample from my garden? Like, how much soil do you need? And should I, like, rototill, like, say, 5 or 6 different spots and then kind of blend a 5-quart pail of each and then take a sample and send it in? Or how do you go about doing that?
Anytime we collect any sample, we want it to be as representative of the area that we want to know or get recommendations from. So you have to keep that in mind when you physically collect your soil from your area, because whatever goes in that bag is going to then represent, and you're going to get recommendations and test results for, you know, that area that you collect the sample from. So you do need to be careful on how you approach your sampling technique to avoid skewing results that may not now be representative, you know, because it's an average over that area. So if you're going to really be intensive about soil sampling, you could do individual beds. So if you have a 4 by 8 foot raised bed, you could, you know, mix all that soil up in that bed and collect about, you know, 3 or 4 little handfuls and throw them in a bucket and mix it up and put it in a bag and you're going to be fairly certain that whatever test results you get back and recommendations for that relatively small area are going to be representative. The challenge now comes in, you know, from a spatial standpoint, if you start collecting samples from your front yard and you want to do a soil test for your lawn, you know, now you're going to be collecting samples that, you know, go across a much larger area. And that's where, you know, the more samples, subsamples we collect, the stronger our statistics are in getting a representative sample. So we have soil probes that you can use. And I know here locally we have a set that we loan out and people can borrow. But you can use a spade and try to get a slice of soil, especially like in a sod. In a tilled garden, you have, or in a garden area, you have an opportunity to maybe do a little mixing. But we want to get a representative sample, and the depth of that is usually confined to the depth of the rooting zone. So if you're doing tilling, it's usually to the depth of tillage. So if you're in a conventional setup where you're tilling your soil down to 6 or 8 inches, well, then your soil sample should go that deep. But most of us, you know, if we're not doing a lot of tillage, we want to confine that to probably the upper 4 to 6 inches. And again, collect multiple samples and avoid areas that you know might skew the results. So there's a publication, just like a lot of our great fact sheets on through Extension, on how to collect a soil sample for both lawns and gardens. We have the same thing for agricultural soils, because this is the most important step in taking a soil sample, because if you don't do it right, you can misrepresent what's actually happening out there. So the soil testing lab and our horticulture website through UW Extension has all those links too. So that would be Wisconsin Horticulture. So that's our main Extension horticulture website. And there's links to the UW Soil Testing Lab and other sites. So I don't have that publication. But it's, I think, sampling. I don't know, Diane.
It's called Sampling Lawns and Gardens. So if you just go to uwlab.soils.wisc.edu, that's our soil lab's website, and then just click on soils, and then it pops up as for samples. And there's the submission and instructions there. So there's a submission form that you would fill out, and that's where you'd put your name and, like we talked about earlier, what it is you want to grow in that area. And then there's also a link to Sampling Lawns and Gardens, and that gives you the instructions on how to get that sample. So like Kevin said, if you have a big lawn area, you want to get an average of what that soil is so that you can treat the area appropriately. So we always talk about putting a W, because of course we're in Wisconsin, on that lawn, and everywhere there's an end to one of the lines in the W. You take a little shovel full of soil out of there and you throw it all in a bucket, you mix it all up, and then you'll be taking out about a half or about a cup of that soil, and that's what you would be sending in. But those instructions are on the lab. There are other labs as well, but the UW lab, then, like I said, will give you the instructions on exactly what to do to your soil. The standard homeowner sample will include phosphorus and potassium levels, your organic matter level, and in my opinion, the most important thing is your soil pH, because again, that affects plants' abilities to take up the nutrients. And it's $15 for a standard homeowner sample. So yeah. All that is on the Soil Lab's website.
Pretty reasonable. AJ, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Diana Alfuth and Kevin Shesso, our guests today, both with UW Extension. Great to have them with us. Diana working out of Pierce County. Kevin works in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Diana Alfuth, from the UW Extension in Pierce County. Kevin Shesso works out of Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties for UW and UW Extension. So great to have both of them with us today, and callers online, so I think we'll go right back to the phones and to Dan in Mirabel. Hi, Dan.
Hello, long-time listener here, first time to get in on a call. Hey, I found out, and I want to just see if it's actually a good way to kill your grass for a garden, but my wife came up with a grand idea to create a huge slip and slide in our lawn that was 10 feet wide and like 30 feet long. And I didn't think to take it out right away when we were done, and the sun did a big job on it. So the next day, the grass was all dead. Unfortunately, this was in the middle of my yard, but I'm wondering if that is a reasonable way to kill the grass, if it affects the soil, or the grass would grow back too quickly. I'm just looking to see what if that's an effective measure to get rid of grass.
And well, we had
it's
a little
pretty effective.
We put a little kiddie pool out for our golden retrievers to have a pool party in the heat of the summer. And the next day we moved the pool and had a nice, perfectly round circle of brown grass under it. So I know exactly what you're dealing with. My thought is the roots of that grass are not dead. It mostly burns those upper leaves, depending on how long it was on there. So chances are you're going to get some regrowth from roots in there. But kind of like we talked earlier about smothering it, putting black plastic or something that doesn't allow sun to get through is an effective way to kill grass. But typically that needs to be on there for about at least 6 weeks because those root systems on typical lawn grass are pretty robust. So if it was more than 6 weeks, you might have truly dead grass under there.
Well, I had a trampoline removed from my backyard that had been sitting there for 4 years. And I can tell you that everything was dead under it.
Oh, sure.
And now I'm trying to get some grass to grow there. So we'll see. Oh, man. Dan, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Ann in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Ann.
Hi, guys. I'm calling because I hate to use any kind of chemicals or poison or anything in my yard because I'm mindful of the little critters, the birds that land on it and so forth. But my dandelions are just off the hook, and I don't mind a few because I know the bees need to eat them. It's their earliest food source is my understanding. But they're just crazy, and this year I thought, you know, I need to do something. So can you recommend something? Should I be doing it now or in the spring to prevent as many, to do something about these dandelions? Because there's more of them than the grass. They've got the grass outnumbered in my yard.
Wow.
That's tough. Other than, you know, getting out there and digging them out, there's not a lot of good options. People want to use vinegar, but that usually just burns off the top and the roots come back. Dandelions have a big tap root, so it takes a bunch to get down there and kill them. So the one thing that I will say, and again, I appreciate that you want to protect the environment and everything, but the research has shown, Doug Soldat, our state turf grass specialist and stuff, the research has shown that at least somewhat healthy lawn is more environmentally friendly than one that's all weeds. Because when it is all dandelions or other weeds and stuff, you get a lot more runoff from that gets down into water systems and stuff than if you actually have at least a semi-decent turf grass area. So from that standpoint, if your lawn has gotten really bad with weeds, it might be more environmentally friendly to take one zap with a weed killer and knock that back and rejuvenate that lawn. And I'm not saying that you need to kill every dandelion or every clover, because you're right, that is a good pollen source for critters and stuff like that. But if you were to look to kill off creeping Charlie, dandelions, that sort of a thing, to get a better lawn that's going to have better infiltration and better microbes and stuff going in there, now would be the time to do it. So a broadleaf weed killer like 2,4-D, if you zap them, and depending on how bad it is, you know, we usually recommend don't spray the whole lawn. If you've got some areas of grass, just spot spray them so that you're reducing the amount of it, and try to knock back the worst of it. There are various organic weed killers that come up on the market and stuff. Some people believe sometimes they have some effect, but it's one of those things where if it's killing a weed, it's toxic to that weed, so it's killing it. It's just a tough situation. If you've got a lot of weeds, there's not an easy answer that's organic. Let's just put it that way.
All right. And there you go. Thank you for calling. Appreciate it.
Kurt, there is a publication on organic and reduced risk lawn care that Doug Soldat is co-author on. So that's another publication, I think, that might have some good information on how to keep a healthy lawn without using a lot of, conventional synthetic-type products. So just another plug for some extension publications. It's called Organic and Reduced Risk Lawn Care, A3958.
And that's a great point, Kevin. And what you just said is it's easier to keep it from getting really bad organically than once it is really bad, recovering from it. So once you get things in a little bit better shape, there are a variety of great things to do, like digging individual dandelions or spot spraying, raising your mower deck, maybe corn gluten meal, which prevents some weed seeds from germinating, and things like that. So trying to prevent it from getting really bad in the first place is easier to do organically than to recover from it.
There you go. And thanks. Kurt in Rib Mountain, your turn. Hi, Kurt.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call. I got in on the tail end of the grub conversation. My issue is all of a sudden I started finding holes in my lawn, and we're kind of in a rural area, so I was thinking sandhill cranes come in, look for the bugs and grubs. And well, then all of a sudden I realized what was happening is we have skunks in our backyard. About 4 o'clock in the morning, I would get up and shine a high intensity light. I'd see the skunks, and they are really doing a lot of damage. Now, my lawn guy told me that because of the extreme heat we had earlier this year in the summer, it just created a boom for grub growth. And now, of course, the skunks are digging up the lawn, going after the grubs. And I was told that they'll just move on. Well, it's been about 2-3 weeks, and they're not moving on. Any ideas?
Trap the skunk. I've had personal experience with this in my backyard, and you know it's a food source, and they know it, and they'll go in there and just feast. Black bears will do the same thing; they'll just rip into that sod and they'll eat all those tasty morsels. And it's so destructive and so devastating when that happens, because you know that's not what you want in your backyard. You want to see a nice, you know, solid turf. So, you know, somehow eliminating the critter is one option. But, you know, with that abundant food supply, you know, it's really a salad bar for them, and they're just going to keep coming back unless you can discourage them to go elsewhere. Ultimately, you know, those grubs are going to mature and fly away, but that doesn't do you any good right now. So, you know, it might be a little bit too late to manage the grubs and you know, yeah, it is a tough situation to be in. And as Diana mentioned earlier, you know, there are ways we can kill grubs with different products. And in this case, you know, you may have to give that some serious thought if, you know, you continue to see this happening. But, the skunk is what, you know. Is
they can make a real mess.
But one thing to keep in mind, too, is make sure that you actually have a grub issue before you start putting on a grub killer or something, because they skunks and, like you said, Kevin, you haven't had Japanese beetles up until this year. So if you had skunks in your yard, obviously it was not Japanese beetle grubs that they were after. So
no,
there are
it was
some...
not. It was moth. Yeah, we identified it, but yeah, it was a different beetle and caterpillar, but it was
right.
Still a food source they were after.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So if you think you have grubs, before you put a grub killer on or anything, peel back some sod and you will see the grubs there. And I think the threshold for treating for grubs is ridiculously high. It's like 10 per square mm-hmm. foot or something like that. But remember, skunks also eat worms and other larvae, and June bugs, our native June bugs, though they make grubs, and as do other large beetles. And so don't just assume that, oh, I have skunks in my yard or I have moles in my yard. That's the one we get all the time too. Is that the moles are there because you have grubs, so kill the grubs. You may not have grubs. So
you may not. You may not indeed. Oh, boy. Thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Diana Alfeth and Kevin Chesso, our guests today with UW-Madison, UW Division of Extension. Kevin is in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. Diana is in Pierce County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my two guests, Diana Alfeth and Kevin Chesso, back with us. Diana is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. Kevin is the Ag Development Educator for UW-Madison's Division of Extension, and he works out of Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. So, gardening questions for them? Give a call at 800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org. Tim in Madison emailed, and on both sides of his driveway, the snow piles up in the winter and kills the grass. Any ideas for ground cover plants that would survive? How about planting bulbs in the fall in that area? The area is full sun. Diana, what do you think?
Oh, that's tough.
Yeah.
So, you know, the reason we have grass all over the place is because it is our toughest ground cover. And first, you have to determine on why the grass dies there. So there's two possible reasons. One is salt. So if you're putting salt on the driveway and then that salt gets shoveled onto the side and it builds up in the soil, that will kill all kinds of plants, including grass. So if it's a salt issue, then we're going to recommend that you change what kind of ice melt stuff that you use, or shovel it into a different area or something like that, because it'll take a couple of years for that salt to leach out of that soil and be able to get stuff growing well there. If it's because it's piled up there and it takes a long time to melt and it turns into like ice, that ice can smother the grass because there's still ice there in the spring when that grass wants to get growing, and that will kill it off. So deciding what the problem is kind of the best solution. But normally it is best to have grass where the snow has to pile, because it can handle it a lot more. So if you put any kind of perennials in there and you have that snow pile there that turns to ice, that's more likely going to smother out your perennials as well, because they're going to want to get growing in the spring, and if they don't see the sunlight, they'll die off. Other kind of ground cover, most of our other ground covers are a type of perennial, and they're not as tough or resilient, and they don't have as extensive of a root system to come back. Now, you could get into some kind of an invasive thing, like maybe vinca vine could handle it, or the snow on the mountain, which, oh my gosh, we really don't want you to plant because it gets all over the place. That has, you know, big root systems and stuff, but and I would probably not recommend like spring bulbs there, because again, they want to come up really early a lot of times when there's still snow out, and if you've got a pile of snow on top of it, they're not going to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd stick with the grass probably, and
yeah,
then figure out why that grass is dying there.
Let's go to Ruth in Abbotsford with a question. Hi, Ruth.
Hi. See, I've had irises for years, and this year I made a new bed, and I have squirrels, chipmunks, and rabbits, and something is actually chewing on the iris rhizomes. What can I do? I've put mothballs out and coffee grounds. I have fencing around some of it, but I don't have enough fencing for it all. And then I'm also wondering about iris borers.
Okay. Who wants to, Diana, you want to have a crack at that?
Sure. So a lot of times when squirrels and things come in, they find that area because of the freshly dug soil. So a lot of times, like right now, if you're planting spring bulbs now, they come and dig them up, and they're attracted to that freshly dug soil. So that may be what attracted them to that area in the first place. But they're really a challenge, because if there's something desirable there, whether it's a food source or nice fresh soil that they like to play in, they will be there. So a lot of times if they're digging in the soil and actually affecting the bulb, you can put like a layer of chicken wire over it that has openings enough that the plants can grow through, but they can't dig into that. If they are eating the leaves on the surface of things, well, then, you know, like you say, fencing can help. You can try a variety of repellents. There are some commercial ones. You can make some home remedies, like some cayenne pepper and water, or rotten eggs, where you crack a couple of eggs and leave them sit on your kitchen counter for a few days until they're all stinky, and then you add some water and blend them and put them in a spray bottle. The thing with repellents is you have to reapply them after it rains, and you need to rotate them, because eventually they kind of hold their nose and just, you know, get used to a repellent, and it's not effective anymore. You know, there are cats that can help with this as well. If it's something chewing on the bulb, the rhizome underground, it's probably some kind of a vole or field mouse kind of a thing that's leaving the teeth marks down there. And again, if you can put some kind of chicken wire around, or sometimes you need to like sink some fencing down around the planting area so that they can't come in from the side. And then with the repellents, you know, mothballs are a kind of a common thing. Again, it's a repellent that some critters find obnoxious, but they're a pretty nasty chemical, and so those are kind of things you should be cautious of using out there. Coffee grounds don't tend to repel anything. But again, you have to try different things, because who knows what your particular critters are not going to like. And then as far as the iris borer goes, that's one that it's a maggot that gets down in the iris borer and stuff, or in the iris rhizome. And I really would just recommend, I'm pretty sure we have a fact sheet on that one. And I'm just looking to make sure where it is. So we have a fact sheet on it. And if you just go to our Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic website, which is just pddc.wisc.edu. There's a tab that says fact sheets, and you can just click on all, and if you just scroll down, you'll find one on iris borer. And that'll give you all the specifics that you need to remember at what time of year you need to do what with it. But it is a borer that gets in and feeds on that rhizome, and sometimes, you know, eventually it can kill it. And these iris borers overwinter in the plant debris and stuff. So if you've had an iris borer problem, you want to make sure that you're removing all of those leaves and plant debris and stuff. And eventually, if it's bad enough, you might need to use an insecticide to knock them out.
There you go, Ruth. Thank you so much for calling. Kathy in Franklin, on to you now. Hi, Kathy.
Hi. I actually have two questions for you. The first one is, we have two huge pine trees in our backyard, and they tend to throw off a lot of needles and pine straw. And so the grass underneath the tree, not directly under it, but, you know, next to the tree, has a lot of pine on it. And what we wanted to do was rake that up and maybe reseed that grass. But I'm afraid the same thing is just going to happen again. So I was wondering if there's something that we can do that would strengthen the soil, or something so that the grass would grow. And then the other question I have is, we have these beautiful hanging plants that did really nicely outside, and I wanted to bring them in for the winter. But we did that last year, and we found these really odd caterpillars escaped from the plants that we brought inside. And so what we were wondering, is there something that we could do to the hanging plant to maybe de-insecticide it, so that it could be moved safely indoors without giving us critters?
Okay. Kevin, what do you think?
Well, I'll touch on the pine tree and growing grass under pine trees, and I'll let Diana kind of talk about bringing plants inside. And I guess, you know, there's a reason why, you know, plants respond to their environment. And I think, you know, the caller indicated, you know, we've got this challenged environment. It's kind of like the earlier question with the driveway and the salt. And, you know, we put plants under, you know, some extreme conditions, and they're not going to be as happy as if, you know, they were growing where they like. So, you know, growing grass in the shade or underneath any tree is a challenge. And, you know, there's competition from all those tree roots, there's shade, there's the, maybe the, you know, the plant debris from the pine needles that are interfering with sunlight and all that stuff. It's not so much the acidity of the soil that some people want to say, oh, you can't grow grass under a pine because it's acid. It's mostly because the grass isn't happy there because it's just too competitive and it, you know, it just can't compete. So, you know, you need to rethink about, you know, why do you want grass underneath a tree in the first place? You know, obviously there's that transition where you've got enough light and you can maybe get the mower under there, but I'm a big fan of just letting the tree occupy its intended space and find other plant materials that are more suited underneath that tree rather than lawn. Because as soon as we put lawn under a tree, what do we want to do? We want to go in there and cut it. That means you're trying to get underneath these lower limbs of the tree, and, you know, get up close to the trunk. Now you can get mower blight, because guess what? We're right up tight against that trunk trying to get that last blade of grass with a weed whip or whatever. So just mulch around the tree. Try to figure out other ways you can incorporate different plant materials other than turf within reason. Again, there's that transition and, you know, the maintenance that always comes with growing anything. We need to take that into consideration. So, you know, it's just maybe rethinking the value of having grass under trees and just how close to the trunk and under the canopy do we want to try to do that. We can thin out upper canopy branches to get more sunlight in there. But ultimately, I think it's a balance between, you know, how much competition there is between the tree and the grass. So,
yeah,
I know that's kind of a non-answer there, but there are alternatives, I think, to lawn that might work in the shade of that tree. Maybe Diane has some comments on what those might be.
Yeah.
So Diana? That's my point.
Yeah, sometimes it's just going to look a whole lot nicer if you come out a ways from those trees and put in some edging and let the pine needles be mulch and just have a nice clean edger that's easy to mow. But like Kevin said, usually people think that it's the acidity from the pine needles, but that's not usually true because usually the pine needles only make the soil acidic in the top half inch of the soil or so. It's the competition from all those fibrous roots and the shade, as well as certainly some needles falling on it and smothering the grass. So getting the grass out, it's going to be a losing battle. Reseeding it, you'll still have the same thing in a year.
What about the plants, the plants that she has that she wants to the hanging plants she wants to bring in without the bugs?
Right, and we all have this because hopefully a lot of us have been summering our houseplants outside where they've been on vacation. Larry, you've probably had limey outside.
Oh, yeah.
So with the cooler temperatures here, we're bringing those inside, as well as you might have some colorful annual containers or hanging baskets to bring inside. And I have experienced this, too. One year I brought in the plants, and later that night there was a tree frog hopping across my dining room floor. So it's not just insects, but other things will tag along as well. So there's a few things that you can and should do. First, really inspect these plants. So look under the leaves and on the stems. Sometimes you'll see little cocoons down there, fuzzy little white webby things that have a pupating caterpillar in there. You might see eggs on the stems or on the leaves that have been laid there by some insect that's wanting to overwinter. And then when you bring them in the house and our house is warm, they will hatch out throughout the year. It's a really good idea if it's in a containerized plant to kind of blast it with some water, so that'll get off some things. You might use a little bit of soapy water, so a tablespoon or two of a liquid dish soap in water, and spray the foliage, underside leaves and stems and everything, and then spray it with clear water about 20 minutes later because you don't want those soap residues to stay on that foliage. But that can kill off some of the soft-bodied insects that are in there. It's also a good idea, if possible, depending on the size of your container, to kind of tip it over and pull that root ball out and really inspect the soil surface and then the edge where the soil and the pot intersect, because that's where a lot of times things will have burrowed down in there. Sometimes you can have, that's where the small frogs tend to go, but you can have like sow bugs and pill bugs and millipedes and caterpillars, as well as wasps that might be looking to spend the winter, and then when you get them in, you've got them flying around in your house. And anything that you see, pick it out of there. Anything that looks like maybe a pupa or a larva, get it out of there. Some people will, if it's going to be a long-term thing to keep inside, knock off any loose soil and put in some fresh soil so that you're eliminating some eggs, that sort of a thing. And then I really recommend that you quarantine that plant for a little bit. So if you have like a laundry room or a mud room or something, a small room that you can put it in at least for a few days, then if anything comes out because it's warmer in the house and so it becomes active, then you've got it confined into a small room and you can take care of it that way then. But if you have, if we're talking about hanging baskets with the colorful flowers and stuff, try to get them in as sunny of a spot indoors as you can, because no matter how sunny it is, indoors window, it's not as bright a light as outside, and those plants do like that bright light, so you can keep
them going.
They're
going to look miserable for a while.
Right, and they might get really dramatic and drop leaves and things like that, but they might still hang on enough to be attractive to keep indoors, so it's worth a try.
Yeah, why not? Good luck, Kathy. Thank you. Brian in Wausau, your turn. Hi, Brian.
Good afternoon, Larry, Kevin, and Diana. I am calling with a question about milkweed. My place of employment is surrounded by open field, and there's a ton of milkweed growing in it, and I'm no stranger to harvesting a little bit in the spring when the shoots are coming up, and occasionally, you know, taking a couple of blossoms and milkweed pods later in the season. However, this season, this is the first year after observing this for, I've been working here about 10 years now, there's no milkweed pods. All the milkweeds are just turning yellow, and none of them have produced seed pods this year, and I find this a little bit concerning, not for my personal enjoyment, but just for the benefit that they are to the ecosystem. I was wondering if any of you guys had any ideas on what may be going on with them.
I would check for aphids, Kevin. I don't know if you have another idea, but the milkweeds by me are setting pods just fine. So I don't think there's anything widespread. But aphids were really, really prevalent this year, and there are a type of aphid called oleander aphid. They're kind of orangish, and they love milkweeds. And if your milkweed plants had a high infestation of them, they basically suck the sap out of plants, and so that may have weakened those plants and have them turning yellow earlier and that sort of thing. Usually doesn't kill off the roots, so the plant will come back next year. But I would go out there and look for aphids all over those plants. And Kevin, I don't know if you have any other ideas of what might be going on.
Well, and I think Larry knows this comment because I've heard it on the radio. It's whenever we have plant issues, we need to go out and do our horticulture CSI. Go back out and really take a close look at the plants. Are there evidence of, you know, like Diana said, insect feeding, or, you know, they're prone to diseases and other things that can happen, and it's just a matter of where they came from, and is it just a one-time occurrence? And, you know, we can't have perfect plants all the time, and even out in nature, we do see some of these, you know, calamities. And, you know, before we jump to conclusions, just go out maybe do a little survey of the area and see if there's some common theme you can see that might have resulted in that. And, you know, it could have been a local frost event or something in the environment that, you know, just killed off some of those flower buds and now we don't have the pods. So, yeah, it's really hard to diagnose things from a distance like this without taking into account all of the different, you know, evidence we might, you know, look at. So it's unfortunate when these things happen, but I would, you know, again, just go back and take a closer look, and maybe that helps in figuring out what may have happened this year.
Yeah, give it a close look, Brian, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And, oh, my gosh, the time has flown.
We could do this for more hours and hours, Larry.
I think we could, Diana. Oh, my goodness. Well, I want to thank you both very much for being with us. This worked well, and appreciate both of your time, and I'll look forward to another visit. Thank you.
All right. And if anybody who didn't get their questions answered wants to email either me or Kevin, we would be happy to answer your questions on email.
All right. Sounds very good. We can forward some of those along to you. Thank you both. Diana Alfoth, the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Pierce County. She also teaches landscape design at UW River Falls. Kevin Chasseau is the Ag Development Educator for UW Madison's Division of Extension in Burnett, Sawyer, and Washburn counties. So great to have both of them with us, and we will have them back and do it again. Just to let you know, coming up next week on Garden Talk, Liz Freemuth will be back with some great gardening advice. So we'll look forward to that. You can join us every week, Fridays at 11, and of course, Saturdays at 6. And you can listen online at any time. There's a lot going on right now that affects our everyday lives. And on the show, we do focus on how to make your life better every single day. The morning show on Central Time, well, they keep you up to date on breaking stories. So, of course, we want you to stay with us on the Ideas Network for talk and news that keeps you informed and learning throughout your day. For sure. Really glad to have you with us here on the Ideas Network. And stay with us because there's lots more in store. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk.